necessarily see at your best. That's where you say, if you can't handle me at my worst, you don't deserve me at my best.
That's when I walk in my tracksuit and I say, someone better get me a cup of coffee before we get started here.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, has anybody even got any coffee around here?
I look at him and I say, don't talk to me before I've had my coffee. And then I turn and I look directly into the camera. Can you do a Kermit the Frog impression?
Kermit, doesn't it kind of talk like this, like Kermit the Frog?
That's not like bad. That's not bad, yeah. No, we were in the car for some reason. That's been coming up a lot lately. I've been going,
one of the Muppets.
Like, hello, Kermit the Frog here.
What does he say?
He just says
his
name.
What does he even say?
You just say Kermit.
Hello, Kermit the Frog here. Like, was it Jim Benson
that did that? The voice? I don't know.
I never knew.
Wait. Did you say Jim Benson? Sunday afternoon, welcome to David Foster Wallace and Gromit, the only officially unlicensed Infinite Jest fan cast. I'm Jared, with me always is Steve, here to discuss David Foster Wallace's seminal classic Infinite Jest. This week, I'm sort of the weekly special guest. Yeah. This is David Foster Wallace and Gromit, hosted by Jared, with weekly contributing guest, Steve. This week, we also read Thomas Mann's Death in Venice, which we're going to get into a... You okay?
Mm-hmm.
I will say before we get into any of the other goofs for the week, you did a good job picking this, considering we were coming off the tales of... what was it? Fragments of a Journal of a Solitary Man and Matilda, given that this ended... very similarly. I mean, the three of them kind of exist if you were to create a trilogy out of them in terms of some of the themes.
Yeah, they're similar vein, yeah.
Yeah, surprisingly so. And we'll get into that, and also we'll get into why I by like the 20th or so page for our PDF of Death in Venice, why I was thinking you might have bunged it, this is hot garbage, and then it really just turned around. You wanna You got any tipples for the week? You got any goofs? You got any spoofs? Anything to let the listeners know about? I got a couple things.
Outside of the tomatoes I was eating earlier, I'm just drinking some good old-fashioned, I think an Italian derivative of coffee, which is, you know... This isn't a tipple, but it is a side...
Oh, my God.
Side story.
Okay.
Sorry. It's a side story. I'm still recovering from being ill.
Yeah.
It's a side story about coffee.
Sure, what do you got?
Coffee. I went to a coffee shop the other day, which is something I don't do.
What do you mean?
Typically. I just don't go to coffee shops. I make coffee.
Hold on. You don't go to coffee shops there. Back here, we've been to coffee shops plenty.
Yeah, like here we go to coffee shops.
Yeah.
Because that's with friends. Well, this was with coworkers as well, so fine. But, not a big fan. And there's a reason why. Because, secret for you, it's not very good. So.
Okay. So what'd you get?
I'm so used to making my own coffee, which obviously doesn't involve anything. You're just... pour over if it's pre-ground or not pre-ground, you grind it and then you pour water over it, or there's a machine that does it for you. You know, it's coffee.
Yeah.
But I've been just so used to being in control of whether or not I want it strong or not strong. You know, because I have some Seattle's Best, which I don't know the origin country for the two Seattle's Best coffees I brought with me. But I've been doing those sometimes and just, like, really laying it on heavy.
Yeah.
Just, like, a bunch in the filter, and I just pour boiling water over the filter. Like, you know, the old camping way, basically.
Yeah.
It's been strong, you know, nice, classic, strong. Because the roast is also strong. It's the strongest. One of the strongest ones from Seattle Best. And you can just pour it over, and it's quite nice.
Yeah.
And so I've been used to being in control of my coffee strength and coffee quality, and so then going to a coffee shop and not being in control of that was quite strange, and it wasn't so good. So,
oh, okay.
Hey, what are you going to do?
Well, let me ask you this.
I had to get an Americano, and it was disappointing.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask you what you got. Well, but that's also because an Americano is espresso and water, so that's a very different experience no matter what the intensity or the brew strength from filter coffee.
Yeah, but I've been a big Americano head, but
right? Listen, this, I get it.
Yeah. Look.
For the Seattle's
it's
best.
It's how the Italians thought Americans drank coffee during World War I.
Is that actually the
apparently.
History? Is that really the history?
Apparently,
it?
That's where the name comes from. Yeah, Americano.
Oh, okay.
It was like brought in later as an Italian variant, and the story behind it is that it's how the Italians thought the Americans had their coffee because the Americans in the war, of course, were well known for their coffee. There are songs about Americans being, you know, the big coffee heads of the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the British have the tea, the Irish have their stouts, the Scotch have their whiskeys, and the Yanks have their coffee.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I tell you, it's probably because...
World War One story.
Well, so one, for the Seattle's best coffee, is probably either from Mexico or from Colombia. It's something that's a very cheap, mass-produced Arabica bean. But for... The Americano, what probably happened, I don't know, this is all just postulation, but what probably happened was, like, takeaway coffee is a very American thing. Most coffee shops internationally, even when I was in Ireland, and in Iceland for that matter, I mean, outside of, like, the big chains of Starbucks or something in the 21st century, it's a very, like, you sit down and you have your coffee. So in Italy, where an Italian roast, much like in France with a French roast, both of which are basically burning the bean into oblivion. I mean, it's a pitch black roast. The only flavor you get is the roasted flavor. So, with that in mind, Cafe Society in Italy, either at the inception of the Americano or even now, is mostly revolving around, or still continues to revolve around, like, your single shot of espresso, maybe a little glass of water, and you sit down and you just luxuriate through, you know, 1-2 ounces of liquid. The Americano had to have been a creation stemming from the American desire to, like, walk with your coffee, to have a cup of coffee. You're beating the street, you're on your way somewhere, even at home you're taking your coffee to go, whether that was in, you know, 1910 or that's to this day. So the Americano is probably, like, you can't really walk with one shot of espresso because you're just gonna, the American mindset behind coffee is, like, you're drinking it fast, so you're gonna go, like, boom.
Yeah, I mean, I think it came from the old tin cup, the old tin cup mindset.
Yeah. Well, then even still, it makes sense because you're...
Easier to prepare.
Yeah.
And then you have more of it.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the tin cup American coffee kind of mentality. I think that's where it came from.
Well, because, like, one shot of espresso has, like, 1.5 times the amount of caffeine in it to one cup of drip coffee. So, like, one ounce of espresso to, like, 10 ounces of drip coffee. So with the Americano, it's like, I mean, in wartime it would make sense, but also in a changing, like, globally minded business world, you're adding water to that so you have a full cup of the 1.5 times strength. It's a stronger cup of coffee, it's a bigger cup of coffee, and it's something you can walk with as opposed to a little... I've been to coffee shops that have the fucking gall to... I'll say, like, oh, can I just get a shot of espresso, whatever you have, like, currently on bar, and a little glass of water. And I'm going to sit there for a minute and I'm going to, you know, kind of like, I got 5 minutes to kill, look at my phone, whatever. And they'll give it to me in a to-go cup that's like, for everyone listening, sorry if this jingling's loud, that's like the size of my key fob. It's like a little paper cup, like a little Dixie cup. And they're like, there you go. And they put a lid on it too. And it's like, am I going to drink this? I got a little lid, like what the fuck is, no, that's ridiculous. That's like portability run rampant. Anyway, okay. I will say, in terms of flavor, if you were looking for a good cup of coffee, an Americano is probably the wrong place to look. If you want to, like, sample a flavor, and what you might be speaking on in terms of your comfort making your own, is that even if you're using a bad bean, a good pour-over, a good ratio pour-over, is going to taste worlds better than any espresso, because espresso is such a... traditionally, I guess, acidic, harsh flavor, even at its most inoffensive. So, like, if you're going from even a shitty bean, as long as it's just a fine roast, or a good enough roast, a City Plus roast, fine grind, Colombian Arabica bean, that's going to taste 1,000 times better than a subpar Americano. You know?
Yeah, I mean, of course. I'm comparing this Americano to Americanos elsewhere. I mean, in the end, coffee's coffee. It's really not that big of a deal. But I'll admit it. I'm a drip. I'm a classic pour over boy. Yeah. Like French press, I guess it's the same thing. But French press is for dopes. Just pour coffee over your espressos are for dopes. Cappuccinos are for dopes.
Well, that's you taking it too far. You've taken it too far.
If I've got espresso and chino heads listening, then, you know, I'm sorry. But it's pour over is the kind of classic way to go as far as I'm concerned. Either that or instant.
No, You know what, though? So, for starters, for everyone listening who thinks that Steve is just trying to be a knob, he's doing this to get a rise out of me because I've worked towards making a career in coffee now.
I said after I said the instant thing, I don't know if you caught it, but I said obviously that's a joke.
Well, no, but you are kind of onto something here. In America, instant coffee is like Folgers and Maxwell House, like these like the big.
Folgers isn't instant.
Yeah, it is.
Folgers is pour over, or I mean, when I got it, it was pour over.
A brew coffee.
I got brew coffee. Yeah,
but in terms of what people
think, they probably make one. Make an instant probably.
When people
think
instant coffee,
Folgers in general is a brew coffee.
When people think instant coffee, they think those big Maxwell House or Folgers like tins, the big red tubs with the plastic top. That's an instant coffee, right?
Instant? No, those are brew. That's what I used to get, and those are brew. The instant ones are the powder, like it's in small packs of powder, like little clumps of powder, and you just add water to it.
Okay. Well, I'm not familiar with their instant coffee offering. I know that, like my grandparents are gonna get. I know
I'm
that
kind
that's
of a
like,
coffee head, so
yeah. Well, when people but like when Americans think instant coffee, those are the brands they're thinking of, like Nescafe, that kind of stuff. But I will say when I didn't experience this in Ireland, you might have to go to a grocery store where you are and let me know what you see. Because in Iceland, we'd get coffee at Breakfast River, but we got coffee at one of like Reykjavik's only actual like nice coffee shops, and that was great. And that was like a real third wave kind of coffee shop, coffee community, coffee cafe, whatever. But in the apartment, in the Airbnb we were in, they didn't have any coffee. They just had like this big jug. It was like a big glass jar of instant coffee, but it was like it looked very decadent. It looked very like the branding, everything about it visually, it was very like aesthetically pleasing, very luxurious. And I was like, that's weird for instant coffee. And then one morning, I think one of the days we were going to go out and about, we were going to go get coffee, but I also thought while I'm having my breakfast in the apartment, I'm going to make myself a little cup of this instant coffee. I've like never had instant coffee. Let's see, how bad could it be? And it was actually very good, like very good. And then the more I looked into it, I found out that like instant coffee is still like not only a very big thing, but like a respected thing in a lot of countries internationally, where there's a lot more care and effort into making like a drink out of instant coffee as opposed to just like black coffee, camp coffee, coffee grounds that you, like a cold cup of water when you're on the trail. This was like a coffee experience in a jar. So that really caught me off guard. So like there is some merit to instant coffee. And historically, when you look at the whole second wave kind of scene of like making coffee accessible to everyone, there is something very respectable to it. And I know there are some companies now that are trying to take the education and the care that they brought to pour over into like the third wave coffee scene with like AeroPress and caring more about like the ethics involved and bringing that back to instant coffee with like the Keurig cups, like specialty Keurig cups like Blue Bottle Coffee and a few of those kind of brands, but then making like little instant coffee packets out of like like it would be like if it was for me with Nominee, it'd be like here's like a single origin Ethiopian instant coffee, which is it's a wild concept.
Right, but in the little like these
tubes.
Big
yeah the little tubes.
Packets. Yeah, that's right. I forgot about Keurigs because Jordan had a Keurig, and I've had a ton of cups of coffee at Jordan's house on that.
Yeah.
That is the Keurig, the thing you put the little cup into and you press it and press a button.
The little K-cups.
Yeah,
I've never been into those because I feel like I've never gotten a cup of coffee that I would ever like pay for, I guess. I've only had Keurig coffee at like someone's house if they offer it to me, or like when my car is getting maintenance done and it's always, it's like a waiting room cup of coffee, which I
it's a waiting room coffee.
Yeah, which I welcome more than the big fucking, like at AMC we had those big urns with just like, yeah, it was like Seattle's best storefront brand, like whatever their lowest tier offering was that they sold to places that don't really serve coffee. But yeah, like
hey, Seattle's Best is a classic though.
No, I'll always love Seattle's Best. I tell you, in Fairwood, that Starbucks used to be a Seattle's Best, and I grew up, I remember as young as like 6 or 7 going there in the winter when they would decorate that whole plaza with Christmas lights well before it was all commercialized, before the redesign, decorate with Christmas lights, and then people would go in there. I'd get a little, you know, a little peppermint mocha as a child, a little something sweet, a little something wintery, and then all the Seattle's Best just started dropping off the map, and they all became Starbucks, and that plaza got rebuilt, and they took away the QFC, and put it in the loft.
Yeah, no, there are hardly, I don't think there are, where is the nearest Seattle's Best to us? I mean, I can't even think of one. To I just me, know that you can buy their you can buy their coffee all over the place.
Well, they...
In stores, market, supermarket.
I don't know.
But in terms of an actual storefront, I can't think of one.
There's one, okay, well, hold on. So they... There's probably one at, like, the Bell Square Mall. No, there's one downtown, though. I know that there are a lot of, like, buildings downtown that have a coffee shop in the bottom that's, like, a Seattle's Best plant, kind of. I don't know how... I think they're pretty big. I don't know if they own... Do they own Tully's?
No?
I think so.
No.
Or Tully's might own them. I don't know. I know...
No. I think somebody bought Tully's. Yeah.
We'll have to, anyone listening at home, shoot us a...
Tully's isn't around anymore, I know that.
No, there's a Tully's down in Soto by the Rainier Brewery.
Okay, well, I'm pretty sure somebody bought Tully's.
There was also, I know Tully's owns Pete's Coffee.
By the Rainier
also,
Brewery?
And there's a Pete's Coffee right by me, and I've never been in there because it's like, I thought that was airport coffee, you know? For everyone listening, airport coffee is in like, it's a bad
thing.
Oh yeah,
Pete's. I know Pete's.
Yeah.
Well, I remember...
There's a coffee
Pete's
shop.
It's vaguely. There's a Pete's storefront in Seattle, really?
There's a Pete's storefront right next to... What's it called? What's that chip shop right by me? Do you know what I'm talking about? I always forget the name of it.
The chip shop right by you?
There's a chip shop right by Green Lake. For everyone listening who lives in Seattle, if you know, send us an email, davidfosterwallaceandgromit@gmail.com. There's a chip shop right by me, and next door to that is a Pete's. I don't know why I never go to that chip shop. I'm always going out to Ballard's and McLeod's. I got to go over there and spend more time there. Get a half pound of cod and some chips, and I think they got Jones soda on tap. They also got to get the clams and chips. Got to get the clams and
Jones
chips.
Jones soda on tap.
Yeah, their fountain machine is Jones soda.
That's wild. Still trying to figure out where the dang Tully's is by the old Rainier Brewery.
It's in that parking lot.
I spent a lot of time down by the old Rainier Brewery.
It's in that parking lot. Yeah, it's part of the plaza.
No.
Yeah.
I know there's a coffee shop.
It's
but
a
for
Tully's.
Some reason,
it's a Tully's.
It's a Tully's.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right. It's just right in there. Yeah, in the parking lot. I've just never been there.
I tell you.
I've been to the brewery, but not the.
Yeah. When you come back around, you'll really like this. There's a. So, across from Bierstube, and for everyone listening in Seattle, keep this in mind because I really want to see this business do well. This is, I mean this in earnest. I really want to see this business do well because it's in the ground floor of one of the, like, new apartment developments. And those apartments can fuck right off. But that real estate is so expensive that I can see if this place doesn't do as well as maybe I might like it to, I can see it going out of business. Just like,
yeah,
being able to, it's a very, like, mom and pop kind of place. But it's,
yeah.
I was
especially
given
with the new station being built in Green Lake.
Yeah.
Right?
And
the light rail station and stuff like that.
It's close by, yeah. But it's on that same street. Yeah, it's called Urban Lux, and I was given it the what for because they have like 4 different font packs on their sign. Like every word is a different font, and I was like, man, that's bad news. But then I looked it up online, looked at the menu, and they're like Mediterranean adjacent. They're a Turkish coffee shop, so like they have like a very small menu, and their small menu is mostly like mezzetrays, dolmas, like little like hummus plates, stuff like that. And I was like, oh shit, that's cool. And all the coffee they have is from, I forget, it's a local roaster. It's a Seattle roaster that I know of that I can never seem to find anywhere. They're normally online only. And I was like, oh, wow, that's cool. But then in addition to that, they have like a Turkish coffee that they use like a Turkish brand that they used for Turkish coffee with like the full, the rig and everything, the little like pot on the stick.
Okay.
So I was but then they also have an Israeli coffee that they have for, that you can buy by the pound, but then they also serve by request. So they're like,
okay,
a very like, it's like a older Turkish man and his family who own it and who run it. And when we went in there the other day, I was like, fuck, this is tight. Cause it's a really big space. It's like a railroad style, like really long space. There's like a fireplace in there. It's all white walls. Very like, really like dark woods, very nice, like minimalist kind of architecture, big windows. And then there's like a little fireplace in one corner, like a couple chest boards on some of the tables for people who bring in the old heads like that. No, it's nice. It's cool. It's a big community involvement kind of space. So if anyone listening is in Seattle, is in Green Lake or otherwise, yeah, make sure you pop by and check that out, because that's worthwhile. Or if you're visiting, check that out, because that was we were there last weekend when we had a little bit of time, and I'm probably going to pull up sometime this week, because they have they had a couple beers on tap too. They have wine. It's a real, like, in the summertime when you're back, that's a real spot for, like,
yeah. Go. Anybody listening, if you want somewhere to meet us,
yeah,
there are two places you'll be able to meet us. It's that place in Green Lake and also the Green Lake Park baseball
field. Well, in Beer Stube too.
So if anybody wants to have David Foster Wallace and Gromit meet up,
the first live pod.
Yeah, live podcast, live reading. Go ahead and shoot us a message or something, or just show up, because we'll be there. Yeah. So, thanks.
No, I think the plan when you get back, for everyone listening, this is, you know, this is just pitching a good day. You can go ahead and skip this part. What the idea would be is you come by early in the morning, we go hit the yim, big pump going, okay? Come on back from the yim, have either a little grilling at the lake, or go over to this cafe and get a little snack going. Get a cup of coffee, get a snack going. Wait there an hour or two hanging out, having a sketch, goofing around. Then get a beer going at the cafe. And then after that beer, head over across the street, directly across the street to Beer Stube, get a big beer going, head back over to the lake for a little frizz-biz or a little b-ball. That's a day.
That's baseball.
Yeah, that's baseball.
Yeah. Boy.
That's a day.
It's nice.
Also, yeah,
that's a real nice day.
Speaking of a little sports,
grilling baseball,
have a little beer.
I mean, grilling. You can't get better than grilling.
You really can't get better than grilling.
I miss grilling. I gotta get a grill going on pretty soon.
You have to
visit some parks. I'm gonna have to visit some parks and see if they've got an open grill that I can commandeer.
You got that balcony, don't you? You got that balcony. You can have a little grill.
I can't. No, I don't think it's allowed.
Oh, okay.
But either way, I would have to buy a grill. I don't want to buy a grill.
You don't want to buy a grill. By the way, for everyone listening, while Steve is poking around with this, just to keep you all updated on this rising action with my iron and my hair and whatnot, got the iron supplement going. Let me just say, those iron supplements, it's 30 milligrams. So it's like 200% of your daily allotted iron. It's to help with absorption and help like really flood my system and get the absorption back up, get the levels back up, get everything situated. But boy, do those smell like death. Those really could not smell any worse. I mean, I guess I didn't expect it to just be a capsule full of like earth and minerals, but mamma mia, that's bad. So stay tuned next week. We're going to have more iron talk. It's going to be really hitting then. I've only done like 3 days worth of the little supplements. So I'd say probably by the time David Foster Wallace and Gromit Beach / Summer Club rolls around, it's going to be 360 degrees of big iron hours. So before we talk about the book, I want to tell you about the hike I went on yesterday, which was a real USDA shitstorm.
I was getting sidetracked by the sea wolves. Apparently a sea wolf is an orca.
That's what they're saying?
And a sea...
That's buck wild.
Well, that's what the logo has.
Oh, geez.
I think that's meant to be an orca. And then a sea... What's a sea hawk? It's an osprey, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then all the different... So Seattle likes to make up animals and call it a sea something.
That's their thing. That's what they like to do.
So there you go.
All right. Just, I want to get into the book. We don't have a ton more time left. We're running out. But I just wanted to say, yesterday I went with a little group on a hike to the Ira Spring Trail. Shout out the WTA, the Washington Trails Association website.
Yeah, okay.
But when we got there, it was a lot like when we drove to Blanca Lake, where like the drive to the trailhead was almost more treacherous than the trail itself with all those potholes.
Okay.
So that that was a real touch and go thing for a while, considering that I drive a fucking Jetta, so it's a very low slung suspension, and I'm kind of like shaking that wheel like, oh boy, I hope I don't rip something off right now. But no, we get up there, and it was yesterday, a sunny day, like 60 degrees out. We got up there, it looked a little bit rainy, there was like some light mist, but we thought, you know, I had like a t-shirt on, and then like a kind of ratty button-up shirt and a hat on, and I was like, that's fine. It's a 3-mile hike, like 1500 foot elevation gain, not too bad. We'll get up there, we'll rest, we'll have lunch at the summit, and we'll come back down. I would say like 5 minutes into the hike, it started hailing, like really hailing, but it was still warm out, so it was kind of like, maybe this is a bad sign. And then we hit a sign from the WTA that said like, trail closed for the winter, enjoy your hike. And I stared at that for a while, because I was like, okay, well, that seems a little, you know. Anyway, so the hike is going fine. We're getting up there. I'd say about, we don't know how far we got, because we inevitably had to turn around. But we hit, I think, about the halfway point, and we got up above the cloud line, and there started to be a lot of snow. And like 3, 4, 5 feet of snow. Like, and we're just like kind of crunching into it, but we're still hot. We're hot from hiking. It's still a warmish day. And then shit really hit the fan, because we got out of the wood, literally out of the woods and along the ridgeline, and the trail went from like this, kind of like a slight gradient, to like a real hard 45 degree gradient. And we're walking on this little bullshit, like, you know, Lord of the Rings Hobbit, Quest of Mordor trail along this near sheer hillside. And it's just like, it's just full blizzard. Snow's like fully coming down. I posted that photo, which doesn't do a ton of justice, but it was just like, that's all like 4 or 5 feet of snow. Snow's like pelting us, and we stopped seeing footprints, because we knew there were a lot of cars there. We knew people were still hiking with us. We stopped seeing footprints and started seeing the like snowshoes, the, what do they call them? Clamp-ons?
Yeah.
We start seeing those. And the trail practice. The trail just starts to go like way steeper. And we see it kind of go around some rocks, and you basically just go straight up to the top of the mountain. And we're staring at that, and then like I can't feel my fingers all of a sudden, and Ashley keeps like sliding down the hill. Her footing keeps going out from beneath her. And eventually we're like, maybe this is an issue of hubris. Maybe our pride has gotten the best of us, thinking that all of us in our t-shirts and jeans can summit this fucking mountain. Maybe it's time to turn around. So it kind of went to shit, but I tell you, for everyone listening, make sure you appreciate the surroundings that you exist in, because I tell you, it took me going on these international trips and taking some of these more scenic hikes internationally to realize how beautiful the Northwest is, and how much I should be appreciating some of these trails that are like an hour outside of my home. You know what I mean? How best
am I camping?
How better am I going to live folk and live authentic?
Right.
That's the thing.
The camping too, the campsites.
Yeah.
Man, you gotta go to the one that we went to, that's by that river and the train tracks. I can't remember what it was called.
Wait, what? Train tracks?
But it was a campsite that was very surprisingly pretty open, and it was pretty cheap. And the one we went to, it was Luke and Jordan and I.
Oh, the three of you.
And it was the one that was attacked. It was attacked by a bear.
Oh.
One of the nights.
Okay.
One of the sites, not attacked. I think the food was ravaged a bit, and so we slept with like axes and baseball bats.
Dang. All right.
But it was location wise, it was absolutely. I mean, looking back on it, maybe I'm. I don't know what the right term is. Waxing poetic or something. Yeah, yeah. I don't know. Looking back with some like
you've romanticized admiration. Yeah, you had that, the rose-colored glasses.
Yeah, but man, it was so classic. It was right next to a bridge, and then on the other side of where we were, there was another bridge, and we were right at a spot at the campsite that was like kind of surrounded by woods. Mm-hmm. But then it slopes down into this river.
Oh, okay.
There's like a pretty big hill, a drop-off, and then we're right next to the river. And on either side, if you're standing on the bank of the river, on either side, you have a bridge for cars and then a bridge for a train that would go by every like 2 hours. So like in the middle of the night, you'd hear the train, and you go, you can go onto the train track, and we went and climbed that train track bridge too. That's and cool. Just like climbed around on it, and you can go under the bridge while the train is going over you.
Yeah,
it was all in all, it was very cool. Wait, it was an absolutely wonderful place.
Where was this?
I can't remember the name.
Mm. Was it
north? It was a bit north and a bit east.
Okay.
Of Seattle.
So like the Mount Baker Forest.
Maybe not that far. I mean, it was. I remember it being a little bit more east.
Well, here, how far did it? Like, how long was it to get there? Like an hour, hour and a half?
Yeah, maybe. Okay. I mean, it was Jordan. Jordan would probably know. Luke would know the name because he was the one that set it up.
Okay.
But it was that one time where he rented out the spot, and he spent I don't know not too much, and he texted him, called 50 people, and said it was for his birthday.
Right.
Yeah, and he emailed like 50 people, and he was like, "Hey guys, it's my birthday. I got this campsite. If anybody wants to come, you're free to come." It was just like a simple little thing. Yeah. And then Jordan and I were the only two that showed up.
Yeah, I don't remember what happened or why.
You were doing something. I can't remember what you were doing.
I think, wait, hold on. When is his birthday? Well, we'll cut that out of the podcast.
We
whatever. Well, I mean,
but yeah, I mean, if I get a name, I'll try and get a name for it so that I can recommend it on here for any Northwest heads out there
who
are listening. Highly, highly, highly recommended.
It's
a classic.
We got to get to talking about Death in Venice because I have to go at 3. So we have like 20 minutes to talk about this.
Okay.
So I guess brief synopsis. Because it is such a romantic or romanticized story, it is such a flowery, introspective, philosophical work. The synopsis would essentially read, here is this author who spends his life sort of as an ascetic, as debunking, as he put, like, bohemian culture and sort of like dissolving the narrative of sentimentality. Takes a holiday for himself in Venice, kind of in one of the little like Venetian Isles and kind of on the coast, and becomes very fascinated by, enamored by, I'd say in a non-sexual way, but very obsessed is a good word, with this young Polish boy, Tatsuya, what was his name?
Yeah, Tatsuya.
There you go, Tatsuya. And then over the course of the story, it's him kind of coming to grips with his own aging nature, with the beauty of youth, with developing the sentimentality and this love for the world around him and this love for this boy or what this boy represents through a number of... It's very heavily referential of Greek mythology, Roman mythology, and going through these stories and constructing a narrative around this boy.
Intertextuality.
Yeah, intertext. There we go. Yeah, but constructing this narrative of kind of his relation to the boy, and towards the end of the novel, you find out that there's a bit of a finite timetable for this, as the city of Venice is being cleansed of and undergoing a large scale plague of cholera. Eventually the story ends with him realizing or sort of actualizing, at least in his mind, the feelings for the boy and undergoing this large makeover to better kind of regain his youthfulness and regain some agency and some sovereignty again in relation to the boy and that relationship they're in, and inevitably dying there on the beach having been taken by the cholera. The first 20 or so pages of this, I had a real problem with. It doesn't help that I was reading it over a period of time real late at night, and just kind of like becoming very bored of how indulgent it is. It is. It's great, yeah. And I. It's a very great book.
It's almost gratuitous.
Yeah. Well, that's why I'm saying indulgent.
Gratuitously written.
It's very self-indulgent, very decadent in that it is flowery. It's beautiful. It's romanticized to a logical fault. But it also makes a lot of sense why I read that Thomas Mann was Yukio Mishima's biggest inspiration throughout his career, because it follows suit with that same, when we read Sailor Fell from Grace of the Sea and Confessions of a Mask and was it Sound of Waves, a lot of these stories where you get like 25 pages of concise narrative and then incredibly self-indulgent, just sprawling monologues with characters kind of detailing feelings of like lust and confusion and obviously with Mishima like honor, and this work is certainly like that, with the first 20 or so pages of basically him saying, you know, wrapped up in his own mind with these fables and these Greek myths, and then you get like one page where he's like, and by the way, his wife died, he has a daughter who is married and no longer speaks to him anyway, and then just push on through with this incredibly it's beautifully written but incredibly masturbatory narrative. But no, once I got past that, I think the moment where he becomes the first moment where he says he smells that, I forget what word he uses, but this very like acerbic or like acrid what do you call it, germicidal smell in Venice, when he begins to smell the disinfectant and begins to go from character to character saying like, hey, why are they disinfecting the city? Oh, sir, signore,
just policy.
Yeah, signore, it's the police, it's just policy, it's hot, you know, we're getting a lot of those winds from east and from the south, and you know, we just want to be careful, getting a lot of trade, just want to be careful, until the very end when you get the one guy who's like, that's what they want you to say, but in reality. But no, I thought it was great. I think you earlier in the week had texted me saying that this, like Billy Budd, is one of those works where
it's gonna be tricky.
Conventionally, conventionally people look at it and say, oh, it's this great homoerotic narrative, but where there is certainly some aspect of that, there is some homoeroticism with the way that these characters interact with one another, or the way rather that he is
he envisions
this boy, he sort of places him up on a pedestal, he's venerated this boy and looks at him like a muse, as this sort of idol, as this, like Billy Budd, peak youthfulness, peak you know, the intersection between youthfulness and masculinity and that confusion therein, and but it
the
doesn't...
Roman face, the blonde hair, the
right,
all that stuff, yeah,
but it doesn't feel, the only moment where it felt homoerotic was where he describes trailing him through the city and the shame he feels in doing so, having to keep his distance.
Yeah, towards the end it gets more, I mean, it's not even homoerotic, it's guilt. And that's when you start saying, when he starts talking about the concept of guilt, and also the dream,
dream, you said that.
The
what
dream
do you,
is pretty,
why do you
is,
say that?
Is kind of a sensualized Dionysian type dream.
Well, it's very carnal.
And so you start, what's that?
I said it's very carnal. I mean, the dream is such it exists in staunch opposition from the rest of the work, because it goes from him being such a reserved, you know, sitting in his tent a good quarter mile away from this boy, just kind of like in the shadow, admiring from a distance, waxing poetic, to now he's amidst all these people drinking their blood. He's like, he's playing with flesh in these very like eldritch, you know, Clive Barker, Hellraiser sort of, this sort of fashion. But what do you mean that is contributing towards the homoerotic narrative?
No, I mean, it was, I'm not necessarily saying it's contributing to the homoerotic narrative. I mean, that's what I mean when I say this one's tricky.
Okay.
Because homoerotic is not what I would use to describe it.
I mean, neither would I, yeah.
Because that's, in fact, I mean, Billy Budd as well, this isn't an example of homoeroticism, because it's not an example of eroticism. It's an example of, and with the, like I said, with the, I mean, the dream seems like a kind of an orgy type scenario, like a Greek, so that's where, and then the shame or the guilt afterwards and before, that's where it becomes this strange conflicting moment where it turns. I mean, it very slowly turns into this, according to him, an internally conflicting case.
Yeah.
It's not an issue of like, he pictures, you know, he's picturing this 14-year-old boy in compromising positions or anything like that.
Right.
I mean, I think if anything, this is a book about, like we said, what we said with intertextuality. This is a book about kind of the Apollonian, Dionysian ways of going about things. I mean, it's Freudian, I think, yeah. in that way. Probably because Freud had an influence at the time, I would imagine. I don't know necessarily. But it's very, I think, the most important thing, the more important issue, rather than the concept of, like, homoeroticism or being in the, I mean, it's in a category in some places, some bookstores, it's in the category of, like, gay lesbian.
Oh, really?
And it's like, it's like, no.
That seems like kind of pinholing, yeah.
It's like, this is, I think we're missing the point when we start talking about this as a landmark of some genre or whatever. I think we're missing the point. It's more, and also with like Lolita being labeled as like a romance book.
Yeah.
I mean, we're missing the point. We're talking about conceptually or psychologically the idea of losing control, and the only solution to losing control is death.
Yeah.
And this being an example, albeit an exaggerated example, right? Because we have a very taboo subject going on here with this kind of strangely romanticized 14-year-old boy by this over 50 man.
Yeah.
But
also with that in mind,
like I said, it's not, there's no direct sexual.
No. That's where this differs from. There's no
direct sexual language.
That's how it differs from, like,
it's about the concept, I think. It's about the concept of control.
Okay.
About the concept of, like I said, Apollonian versus Dionysian, or this idea of rationality.
Mm-hmm.
And losing control of rationality, because there's no forgiveness for him after he understands that he has converted, maybe.
Right.
It's kind of this strange moment of, like, I think it's almost a criticism of, hedonism is a pretty strong term. I'm not necessarily going to say hedonism, but it's a criticism of sensationalist.
Okay. I mean,
sensationalism, sensualism,
you're definitely onto something with the rationalist nature. Yeah. Okay, perfect. Because I was going to say, you're definitely onto something with the rational nature of this and the way in which he goes about it. Because I find it a very, it's definitely a story of reclamation, of him rediscovering his youth and the sentimentality and his feelings towards his family and toward about himself and sort of those relationships, but also a very redemptive story. And the issue that I think man is pointing out with this, or kind of spearheading or skewering with this story, is that most redemption tales are contingent on the main character or this hero figure openly exploiting or in some way taking advantage of another character so that his story or his narrative might flourish, and then in the end there's very little resolution.
Sure.
And you're just faced with this what if in this story, if he had survived in the end, or if he hadn't had that sort of monologue and sort of waxing poetic on his life and a lot of his regret and his guilt, it would have been a story of, here's an older man who falls in love with, in some capacity, this very young boy as a means to rediscover his youth, and then, boom, the end, where we've written a story that's justified some degree of pedophilia, whereas what this story is showing in the end is that he's feeling such immense shame for his actions and realizing that it is not a love for this boy as much as what this boy represents. And it is with that understanding that in the end he finally allows himself to essentially die peacefully. I mean, it seems like his trip, cholera or otherwise, was about being able to just die peacefully, to remove himself from the culture that he had built, or in sort of the life he enacted around that persona and those beliefs at the time, and the hardness and the coldness he developed. So I'm really glad that that was included and that that was the way it sort of wraps up, because like Matilda, like Fragments and some of the things we've read, there are certainly a lot of narratives that, if not concluded with some sort of morose or sinister ending, would be exploitation stories, would be false savior, would be martyrs. And these are all martyr stories, as opposed to some kind of like absolute savior, God complex. You know, I mean, that's like a Bret Easton Ellis thing. But no, yeah, all in all, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very well written. I'm very curious to, I sent you that link, to finally go back and read that critique on this versus, I think it was this versus Confessions of a Mask and stories of idealized masculinity and like what that crossroads of envy, like Billy Budd. It's like, is it envy? Is it eroticism? Is it sexual? You know, is it sexually oriented? Is it having to do with insecurity? How do men interact with one another? I think that's a really curious theme that we've come back to a couple times now. It looks like we're out of time for the week, though, that we're not going to be able to touch base, unfortunately, on David Foster Wallace's seminal classic, Infinite Jest. Do you want to say anything in closing about Death in Venice? I'd say you did a good job picking it, though, I tell you what.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the... I would say this is... I don't know. Is this the more well-known of Thomas Mann's works? Maybe. There was a movie made about it, supposedly.
There were two.
But I think his widely accepted great work, magnum opus, is The Magic Mountain, which is like a 400-page, very in-depth prose about a sanitarium in Switzerland.
We could read that for Summer Club.
Yeah, I mean... That is kind of the, like, capstone must-read of, I mean, I don't necessarily want to say German literature, because that would probably be Faust.
Did you get your copy of At Swim Two Birds yet?
I'm hoping to.
When do you think it will arrive?
I mean, maybe tomorrow.
Okay. Do you think...
It should be this week. So I think let's plan on it, and if not, we can do some announcement or whatever, and you and I can talk about it.
Okay.
And adjust.
Yeah.
But I think for now, let's go ahead and say At Swim Two Birds.
Yeah. So for next week, it's going to be...
This is our first double up
on
the show.
No. We read two Tolstoy, and we read two Lovecraft.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah. Well, the Lovecrafts were pretty short.
Yeah, it doesn't count.
But yeah, you're right about the Tolstoy.
The Tolstoy was culturally significant, very important. This is going to be the first...
Yeah.
I'm very excited about this, because Third Policeman was very funny.
Yeah, so good.
I mean, it's very good. It's very funny. I think that this will be good. We're going back to Ireland. We've read a few Irish authors now.
Yeah. So this is by Brian O'Nolan writing as Flann O'Brien.
Yep.
And this is, I think, before The Third Policeman is this one, At Swim Two Birds. And this one actually, surprisingly, as far as my understanding goes, is the more well-known of the two.
Yeah.
Yeah, At Swim Two Birds is the more famous one.
More accessible.
Mainly because of, there is one detail midway through that we'll obviously talk about next week that is kind of this ultimate example throughout literature of X. And we'll talk about that more.
Yeah.
But that's kind of a small teaser.
Gonna be a little creep.
And it's a classic.
Anyway, this has been David Foster Wallace and Gromit. Also, we had a little bit of Jack and the Bean talk. But we're talking about those coffee beans this time. We talked about Jack and the Bean.
Yeah, we're talking about coffee beans.
We talked about, we had Happy Hikers, a podcast within a pod, all about the WTA and camping and that sort of Washington experience. Be sure to email us at davidfosterwallaceandgromit@gmail.com. Check us out on Twitter, DFWAGpod. And at the website, which is mlmawa.com/DFWAG for the pod, or just click around, see what there is to see. Join us next week, and hopefully we'll get into Infinite Jest finally. We'll see you next time.